From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, is time up for Michigan State University's interim president?
I think we have new trustees who support a tone of compassion and empathy from the top, and clearly John Engler can't project that.
Plus, state lawmakers start the year again seeking change in our auto insurance.
Every legislator you talk to, that you ask them what was the number one issue you heard about, almost always auto insurance. It doesn't matter if you live in Ishpeming or Traverse City or Clare or Detroit.
And the 2019 Michigan Notable Books List is out, delighting librarians across the state.
Having so much diversity on the list, and diversity of the patrons that come into the library, there's really something for everybody.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It looks like time may be up for interim MSU president John Engler. We are hearing reports that Engler is planning to resign ahead of an MSU trustee meeting tomorrow morning, a meeting set up with the intent of firing him. All of this after Engler told the Detroit News editorial board that some NASCAR survivors are enjoying the spotlight. We'll have this developing story today on Stateside. But first, new year, new governor, new legislature, and a new push in Lansing to figure out just how to cut auto insurance rates that are the highest in the nation. Chad Livengood with Crane's Detroit Business is with us now via Skype. And Chad, you recently wrote, and I'll quote you here, I like your language, this years-long battle in Lansing has been playing out like Groundhog Day every year for at least the past decade. Everyone seems to agree Michigan drivers are paying the highest auto insurance premiums in the country, and yet how long have we been talking about the need to change things?
Yeah, there's not a single issue in Lansing that has evaded the legislature for so long. They can't even agree to pass a bill enforcing anti-fraud laws and investigating fraud in auto insurance. Something as simple as that gets gummed up. Usually because everybody goes for the gold in this game. They go for total change of the system of no fault. They go for getting rid of no fault. They go for legislation reining in the auto insurance companies' practices. And so each side can kind of seems to dig in deeper every time. But now we got some new legislators, new leadership, a new governor, and everyone is so far saying, okay, it's time to really do something here and take some fresh eyes to this subject.
All right. And as you say, this is a swampy issue, and they've jumped on it. It's only Wednesday, and already this week has brought a fair bit of activity on this front in both the state Senate and the state House. So I want to start with Senate Bill 1. Happy New Year, everybody. Here's the first bill. Who introduced it and what's in it and what would it do?
Senator Tom Barrett introduced it. It's really kind of just a vehicle bill of sorts. There's not a real meaty proposal behind it. We use the term vehicle bill. It's basically what they'll use to craft a proposal. And then at the same time, the House Speaker appointed a representative from Mid-Michigan to basically run a special select committee on auto insurance. So they're going to, the committee hasn't been named yet, but they're going to essentially have some hearings. They're promising to sort of let all sides talk about issues. One of the complaints in the last session was that the House Speaker and the Insurance Committee Chairwoman at the time, they only wanted to do their bill, which was allowing drivers to opt out of unlimited medical coverage. They wouldn't hold hearings on any other types of legislation. So there's at least a concerted effort this time to let all sides be heard. And at the same time, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry in Michigan with a lot of money at stake between the auto insurance companies, the healthcare companies, the hospitals that treat injured drivers that enjoy unlimited medical coverage for the rest of their life if they're in an accident. And so there's a lot of money at stake, a lot of people who have a business interest that they're going to be fighting on this one, either way it comes down.
But when you stop and especially looking at bills that were introduced in the state Senate, and there was more than that Senate Bill 1, Republican Senator Peter Lucido of Shelby Township introduced several bills. There was one introduced by Warren's Democratic Senator Paul Wojnarowski, Senate Bill 11. But why does this seem to be so much Republican, especially in the Senate? Why aren't Democrats getting on board this?
Well, the Republicans are in the majority, and their bills are more likely to move. That we know that for sure. I mean, Pete Lucido's bill aims to bring some transparency to the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Fund. This is the $20 billion fund that all drivers contribute to every year in their premium that helps pay for the long-term care for tens of thousands of catastrophically injured drivers and riders who've suffered really, really horrible accidents. Many of them are, you know, confined to their beds, and they require 24-hour care. And so this fund is what makes Michigan's system so unique. But there's a lot of questions. It's very quasi-governmental. It's very secretive. And a lot of legislators for a long time have wanted to open this thing up. At the same time, and that legislation has bipartisan support. I mean, has had bipartisan support in past sessions. At the same time, Democrats have typically been kind of aligned with the trial attorneys and the medical providers in this fight. They do not want to see reductions in medical benefits or caps on how much the benefits can be claimed and paid out to folks who survived these horrible accidents. And so they've resisted this legislation that typically Republicans have sponsored that the insurance industry wants to put caps and limitations on benefits to rein in the costs so they can ultimately rein in the rates.
If you just joined us, talking with Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business about the new push, new year in Lansing, and another effort to figure out how to cut the auto insurance rates that Michigan drivers pay, highest in the nation. So we've got, as you pointed out, a Republican-controlled legislature, and we have a new Democratic governor. So how is what we're seeing shaping up in the legislature sync up with what we've heard from Governor Whitmer as far as what she's looking for?
Governor Whitmer on the campaign trail made it clear she does not want to see no-fault benefits be curtailed. But at the same time, she said no insurance reform can really be meaningful unless the legislature acts to get rid of redlining practices where auto insurance companies charge higher rates based on where people live, based on zip code, sometimes even down to census tracts, and neighborhood by neighborhood changes and differentiations. And we've documented that at Cranes before in the past, where at the corner of Mack and Maross on the Grosse Pointe Detroit border, there would be $1,000 swing in the base rates for a driver based on whether you live in Grosse Pointe Farm or if you live in Detroit, right across the street, basically. And so Gretchen Whitmer has said on the campaign trail that this is a must-do subject. And so there is some Republican support out there for that. But there's also some lawmakers have been wary and resisted that because they contend, or the insurance industry contends, if you remove these price differentials from the way that they create your insurance rate, that it will just simply shift those costs elsewhere in the state. So we'll basically shift it from Detroit and Flint to the suburbs of those communities. And that, obviously will have a lot of backlash to that.
And this is the time to have you remind us, Chad Livengood, of the two power players who are ready to force some kind of change, starting with Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. What is he preparing to do?
Well, Mike Duggan right now is in the middle of suing the state of Michigan, challenging the constitutionality of no-fault auto insurance law, and essentially contending in federal court that the law is inherently unfair. It creates vastly different insurance rates for people in Detroit compared to people in Grosse Pointe or some other suburb, and that is not, there's essentially an equal protection here because it's a mandatory insurance. People have to buy it if they're going to drive a vehicle. So he's fighting that front. And then there's this other player in this battle, and that's billionaire Dan Gilbert, the founder of Quicken Loans. And he has been threatening pretty vocally now, publicly, to go to the ballot in 2020 with a ballot proposal to change no fault or possibly even get rid of it and make Michigan a tort state. And he's kind of dangled that out there as a stick to try to get the legislature to act. And Mayor Duggan's lawsuit, he's asking a federal judge to throw the whole law out and make the legislature act within 6 months. So both of them have kind of coming at the legislature at two different angles, that if they don't do something, essentially in the first 6 months of this year, that that they're either going to have to face the consequences of a ballot proposal or a federal judge.
And as I remember reading in a piece you wrote late last year for Cranes, Michigan voters said no. They overwhelmingly rejected a couple of attempts to curtail unlimited no-fault benefits. It was 1992 they said no, and again in 1994. Is there any sense the tide is turning?
Well, the issue is definitely front and center. Every legislator you talk to, that you ask them what was the number one issue you heard about, almost always auto insurance. It doesn't matter if you live in Ishpeming or Traverse City or Clare or Detroit. Just lawmakers kind of heard about it all over the state. And so they think the tide has turned. They think this is the time of the year that drivers are fed up with the cost, and that the public is becoming more educated about the subject, about why auto insurance rates are the highest in the nation, and what are the options to change that.
And we're hearing from, for example, Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey. He is promising to go right down the middle of the issue, not going to side with any stakeholders, according to his spokesperson. Do we think the cast has assembled that could actually push this through in this year?
Yeah, possibly. But Lana Tice, who is the House Insurance Chair that I referenced earlier, who only wanted one type of bill last year, she's also the Senate Insurance Chair. So the Majority Leader might be trying to remain neutral, but he's installed an Insurance Committee Chair who has basically been favoring the insurance industry so far to date. So we will see how this all works out and if everybody can get together and work on this. But, this is a subject everyone thinks that that has to be tackled. And Shirkey has said it has to be tackled in the first 6 months or else, you essentially get into the next election. Can you believe that, Cindy?
No, don't say that. Don't say that, Chad. Chad Livengood, Cranes Detroit Business. Always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Coming up, we'll talk Michigan notable books for 2019. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A cold brew coffee inspired by a feminist leader dating back to the Mexican Revolution. Just what might that taste like?
Imagine having a sip of a cold brew and right away getting some light tones of spices, a little bit of sweetness, tanginess, a little bit of anise in there. You feel some cloves in there. It's just a lot of different explosions in your mouth, and it's sweet. And once you finish, at the end, you get the taste of the coffee. So it's like having a candy with coffee at the end.
That's Mario Rodriguez, co-owner of Soldadera Coffee, based in Grand Rapids. He's with us today as part of our series Beyond the Coney, highlighting the growers, entrepreneurs, and culinary experts behind Michigan's diverse food economy. Mario, on the Soldadera Coffee website, you describe your coffee as coffee with a purpose. How so?
I mean, it's a long history, but what we right now do is we focus on working with nonprofit organizations specifically for women equality. We try to bring awareness through helping at their events, posting on what they're doing. And even at the events, we try to connect with individuals and women who are kind of, we want them to become part of the equality for women or equality for all. We do kind of an interactive environment where people collaborate with us. They write their opinions based on questions we provide during those events. And also, the partnerships that we do by providing our cold brew coffee and trying to expand our mission and stories for women who have gone through, inequality from at the workplace, at home, or in their lives. And that's through storytelling, which is podcasts that we're slowly working on.
So kind of all under the umbrella of Soldadera Coffee.
Yes.
So it's not a brick and mortar store, but you're showing up pop-ups around the state, and you also sell it online. So you have an online presence.
That is correct.
But we have to talk about the story. Where and how did this originate?
Well, the story is very interesting. I mean, we can go back to 1910 during the Mexican Revolution. So the flavor of the coffee was actually inspired by Mexican women who started the feminist movement in Mexico for the first time during the revolution. So what transpired was a few women actually went out of their homes, out of the common, you know, the children and just, you know, cooking and cleaning to actually providing services like nursing. And even some of them actually fought in the war. And through the scarcity, they combined some herbs and spices and some coffee in clay pots, and they brew it, and they gave it to the soldiers as for energy and sustenance. And that's why the coffee, the flavor is called café de olla, or coffee of the pot. That's a flavor. Okay. It's a traditional beverage in Mexico. Now, moving a little more further, the inspiration of the soldadera, which translates as women soldier, came from our grandmother. She was for us our own soldadera, or woman soldier, because even though she was poor and she had 9 children, one of them was my dad, she would help out in the community, her co-workers, when she saw inequality or people trying to take advantage of people who were not standing up for themselves.
And where did she live?
She lived in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Mexico City until I was 8, until I moved to Michigan. And she would take me on this missionary trips, you know, because she raised me. And to imagine beautiful Spanish architecture, carrying carafes and greyhounds, and just giving them to people. And that memory of those cold mornings serving coffee and those AirPods to individuals, that's the memory that I... that inspired me to start Soldadera Coffee with my family.
So it's a business, but it's a mission.
It's a mission, exactly.
And, you know, the idea of doing this kind of marketing because of being online and because of the rise in pop-ups, it gives you flexibility. Are you getting yourself around Michigan?
Yes, we are. I mean, we originated from Grand Rapids, mm-hmm. you know, with the Work with Everybody from the community and the partnerships that we made there through Start Garden, which are local startup companies that helps us, you know, mm-hmm. move forward and mentor us. And we have been able to go from just West Michigan to several places such as Auburn Hills, and in the Rochester area. But mostly right now we're focusing with Michigan to develop a presence. And online-wise, we're working and revamping our website in order to improve our subscription packages so individuals not only in Michigan are able to, you know, buy online and try our cold brew and our coffee beans where we source them.
So it can be cold brew, but you can also make a nice hot cup of this.
Oh, yes, definitely. And people who are from Mexico, when they try it, they say, oh, my goodness, this is what my grandma used to make us. And it's like it's just this whole memories that they get back from this.
I think the idea that yours being a small family-oriented business is a very, very Michigan story. Do you want to stay small and intimate, or do you want to grow? And if so, how big would you like to get?
I mean, we want to go as sky high with this. So right now we're at a point where we're introducing as many cultural flavors, not only the Mexican flavors, but there are probably many different stories where coffee, you know, coffee is part of, you know, our lives for thousands
of
years.
So many cultures, yes.
And we want to bring this into, you know, our company and be able to expand it while still helping individuals through our nonprofit organizations. And what we're looking is possibly franchising for mm-hmm. individuals to start their own companies through the Soldadera brand. Now, right now we're at proof of concept. We want to make sure that we establish, you know, our branding and just the flavors before we jump to the 5-year plan that we have set up.
So other products available yet, or are you working at that?
So we're working at 2 more flavors, still some Spanish-based for the ones that just want a nice black coffee, but still you get nice the nice richness, but not with the bitterness. We're working on that coming up soon. And also more of a cinnamony. If it's too intense for you, the café de olla, you can bring it down a little notch to something more mellow. And then some coffee beans as well.
So where are you actually producing this coffee, Mario?
So right now we produce our coffee at the downtown market in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We were able to work with and partner up with them in order to have an area where we can produce it in large quantities so we can distribute it all around. They're very, very helpful. And their facilities allows us to produce large quantities, up to 400 gallons in one batch.
Mm. Now, do you roast your own or are they roasted to your order?
They're roasted to our order, but we make sure that all our coffee beans are organic, they're bird safe, fair trade. So we do pay a little bit of a premium for them because of all this certification. But for us, that's an important thing. I mean, we don't want to sacrifice quality, but also we don't want to sacrifice not doing our part as a coffee with a purpose, you know.
And helping women.
And helping women,
and
yes.
And helping women. Well, it's Soldadera Coffee and Woman Soldier, which just says it all. And your grandmother's, what was her name?
Her name was Christina, and that's her daughter's name, Christina, as well, in her honor. It's kind of something that my parents say, like, well, I think you're either adopted or you got something from your grandma because you're not like us in that regard.
So Grandma Christina certainly rubbed off on you.
Right.
Mario Rodriguez, who's co-owner of Soldadera Coffee. It was great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me here. And hopefully, once we get some coffee in, you'll enjoy it.
The new year started with the announcement of the 20 titles chosen as the 2019 Michigan Notable Books. This annual selection from the Library of Michigan gives us a real broad look at the rich offerings of Michigan writers. And we thought we would turn to a couple of our favorite librarians for their favorites from the Notable Books list for 2019. Tim Gleisner is Manager of Special Collections at the Library of Michigan. And Kate Mazzara is the Adult Services Librarian at the South Branch of the Clinton Macomb Public Library. It's great to have you with us. Happy New Year to both of you.
Happy New Year.
So, Tim, what are your thoughts about the range of books on this year's list?
I think the range is remarkable. I mean, we have great nonfiction. We have wonderful fiction in the embodiment of beautiful music by Zadorian. Nonfiction with the two books on the Flint water crisis really just ranges across the state from the shores of Lake Michigan all the way over to Detroit. It's a fantastic range of books for this year's selection.
Yeah, there's really something for everybody.
And Kate, when you're there at the Clinton Macomb Public Library, how does this book list, the notable book list, help put the book on readers' radar?
It's wonderful just having so much diversity on the list and diversity of the patrons that come into the library. There's really something for everybody. So from children's books, nonfiction, fiction, even young adult books, we can really find something for everybody.
And Tim, what does it mean for a writer to get on the list? Is there some money? Do they get speaking gigs? What's it mean?
What it means is, first of all, recognition. That's the main thing that we get from many writers as to what's the important thing is that their work has been honored as a book of the state for that year. The other thing is that there's a tour that goes to 50 different libraries of all sizes in the UP and the Lower Peninsula throughout urban and rural libraries. And so each author is asked to do 3 tour dates at different libraries throughout the state. And they do get some compensation from an endowment that has been created for the Michigan Notable Book Program. But we basically here at the Library of Michigan coordinate that tour and get those authors' names out there throughout the state.
And how neat for the writers to be in the libraries looking at the faces of people who are reading what they've really turned out in solitude.
Oh, yeah, and it's fantastic. I mean, really, the recognition that these people get. And I think what's amazing to me is some of the authors, how they sometimes specifically want to go to the smaller places, because generally those are the libraries, those are the communities that can bring in authors of this caliber. We've had one author just last year, I remember specifically, who just wanted to go to the smallest libraries in the UP just because he wanted to deliver his topic, his subject, his writing to those people up there who generally wouldn't have a firsthand experience with something like this.
Well, let's find out your top favorites, a nice jumping off spot for people to kind of start building their New Year's reading list. So, Kate, you're starting us out on a hockey note.
Yeah, The Russian Five by Keith Gave was a fantastic read. It's about the five Detroit Red Wings from Russia that played in the late 80s and early 90s. So the author actually had a background in Russian language before he became a sports journalist. So the Red Wings chose him to actually go over and do the negotiations with those Red Wings to bring them to the United States. At the time, it was behind the Iron Curtain, so they couldn't just leave Russia. So they did come up with some pretty harebrained schemes to get them out. One of them faked a terminal illness. They had to do things like bribing guards and...
very cloak and dagger things. Bribing doctors and things. In fact, we ought to note that if this sounds familiar to Stateside listeners, this book was the basis for a terrific documentary film by Joshua Reel of Port Huron. And he was here on Stateside talking about his film. And Keith Gave worked very, very closely with Joshua in making it. And it is a fabulous story. I have to say, a special spot in my heart because I was at the screening that was held in Detroit. And, oh, boy, was that a moment, particularly when they wheeled Vladimir Konstantinov out for the applause of the entire crowd. It was really terrific. Right. I can only imagine how good the book is because, boy, that film was great.
It's excellent. And I should mention, I'm not really a hockey fan or even a sports fan of any kind, but I just couldn't put this book down. I thought it was fantastic.
There you go. Tim, you've got a children's book that you think works for readers of all ages.
Yeah, I do. It's called So Tall Within. It's by Gary Schmidt from Calvin College over in the Grand Rapids area. It's a story about Sojourner Truth. And the reason why I think it works for all ages, first of all, I'm a father of a child. And the children's books don't usually engage me. I kind of go into the bedroom at night grudgingly to go read a book. But this one was something that I, you know, something I could go in because I learned something. And it's a story of Sojourner Truth from her childhood in New York where she was a slave. Basically starts very poignantly with the fact that she knew she had brothers and sisters, but she never got to know them because they were all sold off to in slavery by the time she was old enough to remember. And it's really told in two parts. One is a poem about slavery and then the abolition of slavery eventually from the Civil War. And then, again, the life of Sojourner Truth. The other thing that's really engaging about this book is just the illustrations as a whole. And it's just fantastic, the faces in the trees in one part where they're just the leaves of the tree, you know, and the thoughts of, you know, is slavery only going to go on forever? Will it ever change? And really, it talks about this title, So Tall Within, how Sojourner Truth eventually came about, the belief that she was tall from within and that people could see this and she was able to free slaves. I know it's very heady topics for a child, but honestly, I think this is a great way to introduce a very difficult subject for children. And again, keeping the parents engaged, right? I mean, that, again,
yes,
for me, that is something that is just a very difficult slog when your kid wants to read that same book, I don't know, 20 times over.
Don't you just get excited at Goodnight Construction Site for the millionth time? Been there.
I do not. And it's not something that I really want to go back to, but I can understand the pain of that, right? That's something that, you know, as parents, we might all go through.
Yeah.
But what's great about this book is that there are parts of Sojourner Truth's life that I didn't know about. You know, the fact that she traveled around the country after, you know, leading people to the Underground Railroad, but was really able to speak on behalf of women's rights afterwards. And the fact that, you know, she ends up in Michigan in Battle Creek, where she dies with her children.
Yeah.
Just a fantastic book.
Kate, back to you for a book that will appeal, I think, to the brain and to taste buds.
Sister Pie. It's actually a bakery based in Detroit, and they have a really interesting business model, which they call it triple bottom line, which is people, planet, and profits. People being taking care of their staff and making a positive impact on their local community. Planet, obviously, being environmentally conscious, so being sustainable, locally sourced food. And profits is the classic financial profits.
And this was actually written by Lisa Ludwinski, right, who's the creator,
yes,
and the owner of Sister Pie, the recipes and stories of a big-hearted bakery in Detroit. And, Tim, this was quite a year for writer Anne Marie Oman. Her book, Lake Michigan, mm-hmm, Mermaid, A Tale in Poems, co-authored with Linda Niemick, made the list. But you want to talk particularly about the essay collection that she edited.
Yeah, Elemental. It's a great book of 24 short stories, all nonfiction, very wide-ranging from authors that people might know, like Jerry Dennis, who did a book on the Great Lakes several years ago, Anne-Marie Ooman, who you already mentioned with Lake Michigan Mermaid, and then people who might be lesser known, like Davy Rothbart. And I mean, it's just a collection of stories. It's called Elemental because it's a collection of stories broken up by elements, by fire, wind, and earth. I believe those are the three.
Hmm.
And just a great collection of stories. One, Rochelle Riley, is my favorite, and she's the columnist from the Free Press, where she talks about her relationship with Michigan winters and why she stays, even though she's been abused by those winters over many years.
I love it.
It's so fantastic. And, you know, and basically she stays because she has a, you know, a love for the city of Detroit. That's the only reason she endures those winters and endures the abuse of a bad relationship, which is the Michigan winter, because of her love for the city of Detroit.
I love that. And the title, Can't Help Loving Debt, Winter of Mine. That's a great title.
Yes, fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, there are 20 books on the 2019 Michigan Notable Book List. You can find out about the ones that our guest just ran down, plus all the rest of them, by going to the Library of Michigan website. Easy to do. Go to michigan.gov/Library of Michigan. How easy is that? Tim Gleisner from the Library of Michigan and Kate Mazzara, Clinton Macomb Public Library. Happy reading, and thanks for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, now that recreational pot is legal in Michigan, how are companies' drug-free workplace policies being affected?
We're going to have to train employers and supervisors to recognize the subjective signs of being under the influence. That's going to be difficult.
Cannabis and the workplace. That's in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, Michigan has now joined the ranks of states where it is illegal for adults to use marijuana, which presents some new challenges for employers as they try to manage their workforce in light of lawful marijuana use by employees. Tryon Solutions is a Troy company providing human resources, payroll, workers' comp, compliance, and other such services to small and mid-sized companies, a lot of them in Michigan. James Byers is Tryon's chief legal officer. And Jim, when Michigan voters said yes to legalize marijuana last November, how much of a legal and HR challenge did that immediately create for employers around the state?
You know, I think it's a big challenge, Cynthia. It's going to require employers to evaluate their entire drug-free workplace, to evaluate the training that they provide to their supervisors, to manage their workforce, and to try to make sure that people do not show up under the influence or be impaired in the workplace under marijuana.
Because it really begs this question, where does an employee's right to use recreational pot end and the company's desire for a drug-free workplace begin?
Well, that's a great question, because I think both employers and employees should sit down and make sure that everyone understands that although marijuana now may be legal in the state of Michigan, it is still a federal Class 1 controlled substance. So number one, your employee should have to understand that it's not legal to use marijuana in public or in a vehicle or on private property such as an employer's business at any time. So I want to communicate that to them.
That has to be clear. In fact, I had a conversation recently with a top HR executive of a company that has both workers in plants and also people working in the offices, and his view was completely, we don't care that pot is legal in Michigan. We care that it is illegal under federal law. Are you hearing that from a lot of the companies you work with?
You know, absolutely, because a lot of our clients do have contracts with state and local governments, and under those contracts, they are required to maintain a drug-free workplace, so they still have to meet with those federal requirements.
So, you know, one of the big uncertainties I've got to imagine, Jim, for employers is marijuana testing itself. I mean, knowing that byproducts of marijuana can linger in urine and hair and saliva for days and even weeks after someone's last used it, and certainly long after any buzz has gone away. So what does that uncertain testing mean for employers as they want to try to conduct drug testing?
Well, that's a huge issue because employers can certainly have the policy that employees can certainly not show up under the influence or be impaired by marijuana at the workplace. Now, how do we determine that? Most employers and supervisors are pretty well trained on recognizing if an employee is under the influence of alcohol. You know, breath, slurred speech, problems with motor functions. And if you have a belief that that employee is impaired by alcohol, you can take out a pocket breathalyzer, and it will tell you if alcohol is in that person's system and to what level. We don't have that with marijuana. As you mentioned, if you give an employee a saliva or a urinalysis test, it may show THC in that person's system who may have used it 3 or 4 days ago. So that in itself won't tell you if the person's under the influence at work. So I think we're going to have to train employers and supervisors to recognize the subjective signs of being under the influence. That's going to be difficult.
And, you know, in thinking of the labor pool, it is tough enough, as you know, for companies to find and hire new employees these days. And if pot's available, if it's accessible, if it's legal under Michigan law to use, then people are going to use it. Could that fact tighten up the already historically tight labor market, in your view?
Well, you know, it is. And we're finding that employers are looking at and thinking about revising whether or not they're going to have a zero tolerance for cannabis in someone's system, regardless of if they show up under the influence. And number one, employers have to understand, look, you've got to take disciplinary action if someone is clearly under the influence at work. It's just a safety risk. You can't do it. But the question that you raise is, you know, with 3% unemployment in the state of Michigan, a lot of jobs that don't have high safety criteria, the employers are, once again, looking at whether or not pre-employment testing, for instance, if they're going to continue to test for marijuana. States like Colorado, we've seen studies out there that employers are sort of loosening those restrictions on pre-employment testing for THC.
You had commented that certainly businesses that do business with the government must have that drug-free workplace policy. Can businesses that don't have that kind of relationship, can they just choose to have no policies about drugs? I mean, I'm just wondering, are there state laws that cover this?
You know, not actually. No, they wouldn't have to have a policy. 99% of employers do, and I would not recommend that at all because, once again, I think with this new law in effect, I think employers should communicate with their employees and say, look, my fellow associate, don't be under the assumption that just because marijuana is legal and you use it off-site that we still can't take disciplinary action against you if for some reason we have to test you. For instance, you're involved in an accident at work. A lot of times the workers' comp insurance company will require that that person submit to a drug and alcohol test as part of their treatment. We can still decide to suspend or terminate or discipline you under the law if marijuana is in your system. So you got to communicate that to the employees so there's no misconception.
And what is your advice to employees right now where things stand?
I would certainly get with your HR person at your company and make sure that you clearly understand the company's policy.
Jim Byers, legal counsel for Tryon Solutions in these changing times as employers face questions over their drug policies after Michigan says yes to legalize pot. Jim, great talking with you. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you, Cynthia.
John Engler's reign of terror is over. That blunt, all-caps tweet came out earlier today from Michigan State University trustee Brian Mosselem as the board calls a last-minute meeting for tomorrow morning to discuss the future for interim president John Engler. Mosselem says, we've got the votes to fire Engler, and late reports are John Engler is resigning. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells is here now to break down this busy day for us. Kate, you know, you stop and you think, John Engler said, and I'm going to quote him here, when I started this interim position, it was never my intent to have an adversarial relationship with some of the survivors. But you know better than anyone. You have covered this on the ground. He has been fighting with Nassar survivors ever since he came back to MSU as its interim president. He's angered students, faculty, alums. And here we are sitting here talking about the fact that he's getting ready to resign.
That's what the early reports are at this point. And we should note that he, as of like literally this moment, and I've been checking Twitter, we don't have a resignation from John Engler. He has not, you know, submitted this. That could change at any moment. It really does look like things are coming to a head. And you mentioned, it's been this slow burn, right?
This slow burn. So break down today for us. What has been going on? It's that tweet from Brian Mosslem was quite a shot across the bow.
Reign of terror. Yes. That's not subtle. So it's really been a one-week process of coming to the head. Last week, I'm at this Board of Trustees meeting, and we're talking about whether or not Engler is going to last until the new president of MSU is hired, whoever that will be, and announced this summer. And Diane Byram, she was just been elected chairperson of the board, and she really sounded to me like, you know, Engler's just going to ride this out. She didn't use those words, but she said he's only here for a few more meetings, and then we'll have this new president. Then a few days later, Engler has a sit down with the Detroit News editorial board. He makes some insensitive comments. Among them, he says that he believes some of the Larry Nassar survivors are enjoying the spotlight, the awards and recognition, and that that time is coming to an end. You can imagine that the immediate reaction from survivors was not great. Mm. Rachel Denhollander tweeted that, you know, actually what the time in the spotlight had been like for her was that she had to change when she takes her three-year-old grocery shopping so that her three-year-old doesn't see coverage of her mom talking about sexual assault. And then what happened after that in these last few days is we saw more and more national media pick up on this story. Those comments from Engler were so over the top and so blatant that the New York Times picked it up, and really the heat on MSU started building. So that today we got this announcement. They're going to hold a meeting tomorrow. There was one item on the agenda, and that was a personnel action. There was no secret here. And they had the votes to fire him. It looks like now he's not going to wait for them to do that.
And you talked with Brian Mosslem about this a little earlier today. What did you hear from him?
Well, and I asked him, why now? You know, why is this changing here? And he said the number one thing is that there is a new board of trustees. There are three new members on that board of trustees, and that they are different. They want reform. They want a cultural transformation.
I think Friday was the last straw. And I knew that when Kelly Tebe and Nancy Schlichting called me with concern, that is the first time other trustees have ever called me after his comments. I knew this board was headed in a different direction.
And, you know, you stop and you think of this history. And David Jesse in today's Free Press, in a late filed story in the Free Press, breaks down how Engler came to MSU in the first place, because there were two possibilities. There was former Michigan Governor John Engler and former Michigan Governor Jim Blanchard, Engler being a Republican and Jim Blanchard being a Democrat. And David Jesse reports that it was the state legislature controlled by Republicans that made it very clear to MSU, hire Engler or get ready to lose millions of dollars in state aid. And they hired John Engler.
Yeah, that hiring was always controversial. You know, you remember last year the faculty took a vote of no confidence in the Board of Trustees. And it was coming. I mean, it really is crazy that this is happening now, because it is 1 year after the Nassar sentencing, which is when former President Lou Anna Simon stepped down, and they had to find an interim. And they really wanted somebody who was just going to be able to steer them through this crisis. It'll be interesting to see how we look back at the Engler tenure. I think he would describe his greatest success as being the settlement, the $500 million settlement with the Nassar survivors. But in some ways, you can argue that he extended that crisis, the worst crisis of MSU's history, for an additional year by having this bewildering, antagonistic relationship with survivors that just wasn't necessary.
And to that point, it's worth having everybody just take a moment now to listen to this moment with one of the Nassar survivors speaking to the board.
So this is last year. You're going to hear from Kaylee Lorenz. You may remember this story. It was pretty big at the time. Kaylee Lorenz goes up to the board and she says, look, I had a private sit down with John Engler. This is before the big settlement had happened. And Kaylee says, John Engler told me he would give me money right now if I settled the lawsuit. And she says, I didn't want to do that. And at that point, Engler starts to tell her that the time that she has allotted to speak is over.
President Engler then tried to back up his statement,
Kelly,
saying,
time is up.
No, well,
your time is up.
No, well, there,
you failed. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Let her speak. Let her speak. Let her speak.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is the sound of gasoline being poured on a
fire.
Well,
I'm watching your face like literally cringe.
And I've
heard this before.
Oh, yes. And, you know, I've got to stop and say, I've been covering news in this state for a long time, and I remember, and it surprises me, I guess on a personal sense, John Engler has triplet daughters who are in their 20s. And he came in saying, I don't want an adversarial relationship with the survivors. And nothing that's happened since he came in syncs up with any of that.
Well, I think MSU, both the previous board and Engler, have been criticized for being tone deaf, you know, and we saw that from President Simon, that to them, what they're doing and saying makes sense within the context of what they see as their fiduciary responsibility to MSU. But it's the inability to in any way sort of recognize or establish that they get it. They get what went wrong, and they get that the culture in the administration and at MSU was a big part of why Larry Nassar was able to sexually abuse hundreds of victims for decades. And then unless you have that cultural change, it doesn't matter if Simon's gone and it's Engler instead.
You just stop and you just think of even from as we were noting that this is the 1 year anniversary of the first day of impact statements in Judge Aquilina's courtroom. And that was a mess optically, because Luana K. Simon was not there. And then she came. She said she didn't want the attention on her, but she was there. You had Dean William Strample remind everybody what happened with him. I mean, this was like one thing after another.
Right. So there have been three criminal there have been three cases brought against three different individuals since Larry Nassar at MSU. One of them is against President Simon for allegedly lying to police. One is against the former gymnastics coach, Kathy Klages, and the other, like you mentioned, former osteopathic college dean, Dean Strample, Bill Strample, for
Larry Nassar's boss.
Larry Nassar's boss at the time for allegedly not following up to make sure that Larry Nassar was following proper medical procedure, and also allegedly Strample sexually harassed female medical students himself. So it's been a rough year for MSU, to say the least.
And as we hear from reaction from the MSU community, what are we hearing from, first of all, from survivors to this news that that is this breaking news? As we talked just before 4 o'clock, we're still kind of keeping an eye on East Lansing, but it appears clear that he's ready to resign before being fired tomorrow.
Right.
To see that. What are we hearing from survivors about that?
One of them tweeted, I can finally take a deep breath. And one of the moms tweeted that she just wanted to take a moment to recognize that this was happening. You know, I think it's another instance where these survivors feel like they have been saying the same thing over and over and over again, and that it takes something really crazy and almost outside of them to bring this to a crisis point. You know, it was the same thing with President Simon's resignation. That didn't happen until the end of the sentencing, when all of the national media in the world, it seemed like, was covering the Nassar case. And in this last week since Engler has made these comments, you know, these are not the first comments he's made like this, but suddenly this became the hot story of the moment, and now he's stepping down.
Are we hearing anything at all out there about who might replace him?
There's plenty of rumors and speculation. The board has not said anything officially yet, but it's expected that as soon as he does resign, or if they go ahead and fire him tomorrow, they've got to name a new interim to take over the helm for the next few months.
You know, I stop and I think about the Believed podcast that you and Lindsay Smith did, taking us into that question, how did this happen for so long and why these women were not believed? And you did the episodes, but then you had to come back with the epilogue, and you had things didn't go so well. It was not all wrapped up with a bow, and you had that Time's Up clip, Time's Up, Kaylee. Is this what MSU will need, do you think, to move forward and to take it to that level where they can say, we are in a better place?
I think you definitely could not move MSU out of its worst crisis point with Engler at the helm, just because the relationship and the trust there between the faculty, the staff, the students, many alums, not to mention, of course, the Nassar survivors, just wasn't there. We will have to watch and see whether MSU is able to do what it has been promising to do for a year, and that is have real transparency and reformation.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, and of course we will have much more on this developing story on tomorrow's Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Sarah Leeson. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.